This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. College campuses are known as havens for free speech, but there was a time in the 60s that it wasn't always the case, at least not at UNC Chapel Hill. North Carolina legislature imposed a speaker ban on the university in the mid-60s, prohibited known communists from speaking on campus. Lawmakers said they had to do it to combat the threat of communism, the threat to our Constitution. From communism. Chapel Hill students organized a protest and ultimately sued the chancellor and board of trustees. The students won. This year is the 50th anniversary of the speaker ban, and some of the people involved in the fight are going to be speaking tomorrow at the UNC campus. Bob Spearman's former student body president at UNC Chapel Hill. He now practices law in Raleigh. Jerry Carr worked with Students for a Democratic Society, both instrumental in overturning the ban, and they're here in the studio today. Bob and Jerry, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bob, give us some of the background on the events that led up to the speaker ban. What was happening in 1963 when all this was starting to...
Well, what was happening in 1963 was that... There were a lot of demonstrations that were going forward in Raleigh where students and others from Shaw and from North Carolina State and other places were demonstrating in an attempt to protest and protesting the fact that that blacks could not be served in restaurants and basically in the Sir Walter Hotel, particularly where the legislature was most of the legislature was staying when the session was going on. And what happened was that these protests became very, very controversial as far as the legislature was concerned. And I think it's probably the case, really, that the legislature adopted the speaker ban law in large part to kind of clamp down on the protest. And I say that in part because one of the persons involved was Clarence Stone, who was then the president of the North Carolina Senate. And Clarence Stone, about 6 months after the law had been passed banning communist and other left-wing speakers from appearing on the campus, said that, well, I noticed that there are not nearly so many protests going on now that we've taken this action to ban the communist.
Well, interesting that there's a connection between communism, a geopolitical conflict, and racism and segregation here in the South. It seems like a kind of a far-fetched connection, but an easy one to make in 63 for white lawmakers.
Well, it was probably easy in 1963 because one has to remember that a lot of the lawmakers in North Carolina, and I should point out here that there were not any black lawmakers involved in. Not only were they not involved, there were no black lawmakers who were either in the North Carolina House of Representatives, nor were they in the North Carolina Senate.
Yeah, and it's not to say the Communist Party of the USA was involved in the civil rights movement and was very definitely part of the movement to end segregation. So it's not to say the Communist Party wasn't involved, but that it was a democratic movement to change a system of segregation in the South.
Well, it certainly was. I mean, There was some peripheral communist involvement, but the thrust of the civil rights movement to say that was communist-inspired is just silly.
So tell us about the climate then at UNC. You talked about the protests in Raleigh, and then there was a speaker ban, and it did ban known communists. And who else was in?
Well, it also banned persons who advocated violent overthrow of the government, and it also banned persons who had pled the Fifth Amendment. Wow. With respect to any of their alleged communist activities. And the point, really, I think, for Chapel Hill was that shortly after the ban was passed, it became clear that the students thought the ban was just utterly silly and absurd. And I think trying to look back now to what I remember then, I think all of us really as students just felt it was ridiculous to claim that we were somehow going to be snookered by some communist who might appear on the campus.
So, Jerry, you were a member of the SDS at the time, so remind us of the SDS, what they were doing, and then your involvement then in the effort to overthrow the ban.
I came to UNC Chapel Hill in the fall of 1964. I came from University of Alabama, Tuscaloosa. The summer of 64, I had a series of experiences in the civil rights movement there, and I had my eyes opened to the extent to which I was living in a pretty bad society. I saw that the police force had Klans member on the force. I saw police acting as criminals, breaking the law, assaulting people. I saw the Klan having the free run of the place, and there was a very serious violent attack on demonstrators in June in Tuscaloosa. So it was it changed my thinking about a lot of things. Now, Gary Waller, who was to become my lifelong friend, while I was in Tuscaloosa, he was in Chapel Hill in the graduate program in sociology, and he participated in the civil rights activities, sit-ins, and so forth here in Chapel Hill. And so when the two of us compared notes on our experiences in different states, we realized we had a rather common way of looking at the racist South. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to pursue activities that would contribute to the civil rights movement. You're talking about the linking of communism to the civil rights movement. I remember quite well traveling through the South and seeing these huge billboards with a picture of Martin Luther King sitting with a known communist. These were posted around the countryside. There was a strong movement to make that link. And as you say, there were, and I think as Bob pointed out, there were some communists. But by that period of time, the FBI had virtually destroyed the Communist Party through infiltration and the dirty tricks and the McCarthyism, yeah, and the Smith Act, which enabled them to jail about 100 leaders of the Communist Party. So there wasn't much left of it. I think that probably people in the civil rights movement, I know that people in the civil rights movement appreciated the white people who would try to help them out.
Right. And the question is whether it's part of a vast international conspiracy led by Moscow or whether or not people with communist sympathies would join a movement that was actually spawned here in the South as a local homegrown effort to overcome an evil institution. I think that's probably what we're getting at. But Bob, while the legislature would want to make that link, it's not clear that students who might believe that this ban on free speech is an absolute violation of their constitutional rights may also have other ideas on segregation. Did they make the link? Was everybody sort of opposed to the ban also opposed to segregation?
Well, I'd say a couple of things about that. First, when I was at Chapel Hill, and I was there until 1965 when I then left after graduating, at that point, I had never met a single student at Chapel Hill who was in favor of the speaker ban. And I think I mentioned that before, that the students just regarded the speaker ban as insulting and silly. And once one came very close to the litigation, which is happened after I had departed from the campus, at that point I think there was one poll that showed that 80% of the students strongly favored letting these purported communist Apthecker and Wilkinson, who had pled the Fifth Amendment, speak on the campus. So there was not much linkage as far as the students were concerned.
No, but I mean, in terms of segregation, were all of those students who might have opposed the ban also opposed to segregation? They might have had very different ideas on race. These are actually two separate issues.
Oh, they are two separate issues. And I know that just from my own campus work at Chapel Hill that, for example, I was in favor of the public accommodations law, which was then pending in Congress, which was pending at the time of Kennedy's death and then taken up by Johnson. And at that point, I had voted in favor of it in some National Student Association Congress. But I found that when I ran for student body president, which was in the spring of 1964, that I was sometimes highly criticized by students who thought that people ought to be able to select and serve their own customers, and they should not be required by law to serve black people. So there was more difference of opinion probably on race, certainly on race, than there was on the speaker ban.
Jerry, let me talk about the two speakers who were invited in defiance of the ban that the legislature had imposed or enacted, Herbert Aptheker and Frank Wilkinson. SDS, you remember that organization, invited them. Tell us who they were and why they were invited.
About 2.5 years or more had passed as university administrators tried to get the situation changed. And what it finally came down to were sort of compromises and the actions by the Board of Trustees and so forth, but speakers were still banned. At that point, SDS said, well, let's just go get a real live communist and invite them to the campus. And again, we were influenced by the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King had set a great example. Sometimes, under some conditions, there are laws that you have to break. And I think that was sort of a principle for us. So that's what we did. And we invited Herbert Aptheker, who was a scholar, had a number of books published. His area was race relations. And Frank Wilkinson, who had pled the Fifth Amendment and had been jailed as a result of these witch hunt hearings that had taken place. I'd like to make the point, there's a question that needs to be asked. How did UNC administrators know who to ban when speakers were invited? What we found out was they contacted HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, which had been part of this witch hunting process, and HUAC told them who to ban. They were cooperating with this banning law, and they were relying on that rather notorious House committee to do that.
So if you could find a closet communist not on the HUAC list, you're home free, right? That's the idea. And that is interesting. How do we know who's card-carrying and who's not? Obviously, if you pled the Fifth before the McCarthy hearings, well, then that's public record.
Right.
And, you know, card-carrying CP members were also could be well-known.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And then, so they were invited, these two, in defiance of the ban. It's interesting, Bob, because your successor, Paul Dixon, was student body president, and he was there when the two speakers came to campus. And we have a little bit of tape of him addressing students as they begin to gather to hear these two speakers.
As informed us that Dr. Aptheker may not speak on the campus, we will therefore move to the other side of the wall. I would request that you, the student body, stay on this side so that you don't interrupt traffic.
So what happened that day, Jerry?
SDS, and I was just talking to Bob before SDS came along. SDS earlier had gone to dormitories, had held rallies, had been actively educating and discussing with the student body what this fight was all about. And when we arrived at that day when the speakers came to speak, there were a lot of people that turned out who wanted to hear the speakers. It was set up, I think, in a rather ingenious kind of way of having the speakers speak over that low wall on Franklin Street to 1,000 or 2,000 students that had come to hear them speak. Now, they did that after they went over to the Civil War monument of Silent Sam and tried to speak, and Chief Beaumont played his role and ordered them not to speak.
Chapel Hill police.
The Chapel Hill, the campus police.
Campus policemen.
I told them that they couldn't speak, and then they retired to Franklin Street and spoke over the wall. And it was a kind of clever way of ridiculing the notion that you can't erect walls and ban ideas or speech.
So what happened to the ban, Bob?
What happened to the band was that the students, when the couple of speakers had to speak from Franklin Street instead of speaking from the campus, they very promptly filed a lawsuit, and they were represented by a Greensboro attorney, McNeil Smith. And the lawsuit went on for a couple of years, but in early 1968, the students won the case. And in winning the case, I think they probably achieved exactly what they hoped and intended they were going to achieve.
At what level was this heard?
It was heard before a three-judge court.
Yeah.
And it was heard before a three-judge federal court, because that's what one at the time had to do when one was challenging a state statute.
Right.
So that was essentially what was involved in that situation. But it was heard before a three-judge court, and then a few days later, it was a very short time, the governor, Dan Moore, announced that the state was not going to appeal. So that really was the end of the speaker ban.
Do we know how many other states and other institutions had similar bans that may have fallen as a result of this court ruling?
I don't know how many other states' bans would have fallen, except that I would say that in North Carolina, there was the three-judge court was adjudicating the validity or the lack of validity of the North Carolina law. So it was confined to that particular issue, especially since the state did not attempt to appeal the case.
Yeah, so that one is gone. But I'm wondering too, in terms of the overall impact of this, and the states, or I should say, the universities' administration's role in this. Bill Friday was chancellor of the entire system, and his role in this is sometimes controversial. He presented himself as a guy who was opposed to it and had to work very cautiously politically to walk a line.
Well, that you tend to minimize his or attack his role or denigrate it a little bit there, but I think that's entirely wrong. Really, I don't think anybody could know Friday or Bill Aycock, who was the chancellor. Actually, Friday was the president of the system, without knowing that they were absolutely bound and determined to defeat the speaker ban. I mean, Aycock and Aycock's colleagues immediately after the ban was passed began trying to figure out what could be done to get rid of it. And they just followed. These people hold public positions. And when those people hold public positions, they were not entitled to just sort of flaunt a state law. I mean, it was a stupid state law. It was a bad state law. It was a really ridiculous state law. But nonetheless, that did not mean that the university, whether it be Aycock or Friday or anybody else, could just say, we don't like the law, so we're not going to follow it. And I think that's what the students ultimately did, was to arrange what amounted to a test case. And by virtue of the test case, the students prevailed in their views.
And getting yourself fired and replaced by a guy who does favor the ban doesn't do anybody any good.
It would not have done anybody any good.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Bob Spearman, former student body president of UNC Chapel Hill, now practices law in Raleigh. Jerry Carr, a member of the Students for Democratic Society. Bob and Jerry are going to be speaking at an event, The Rise and Fall of the North Carolina Speaker Ban. That's tomorrow, Wilson Special Collections Library. Program's at 5 o'clock, free and open to the public, and you can go there and say whatever you want. Thanks to you guys. Thanks. Coming up after a break, we're going to talk with Rachel Herrick about her fictional character, the Obeast. Stay tuned.